from WBUR Boston and NPR. I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. The music of Beethoven, writes master conductor Sir John Eliot Gardiner, tells us what a terrible struggle it is to overcome human frailty. Mozart, he writes, gives us maybe the sound of music in heaven. But Bach, he says, Johann Sebastian Bach, gives us the voice of God. This hour On Point, Sir John Eliot Gardiner on Bach, the man and his music. You can join us on air or online where this conversation is always on. How do you hear, absorb, explain the power of Bach? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Or join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Joining me now from New York is Sir John Eliot Gardiner, conductor, scholar, master interpreter of Baroque music, founder of the Monteverdi Choir and the English Baroque soloists, with whom he has performed numbers, many of Johann Sebastian Bach's vocal works, most notably all of the cantatas available on his record label Soli Deo Gloria. His new book takes on the man and his music with a maestro's intimate awareness. It is Bach, Music in the Castle of Heaven. Sir John Eliot Gardiner, welcome to On Point.
Thank you.
Albert Einstein, you quote right off the bat saying when it comes to Bach, his advice is, listen, play it, love, revere, and keep your trap shut about his life's work. You've written a great long book about it. I guess you're not taking Einstein's advice. What's your project here, sir?
No, we could do just that. You know, we could just sit and listen to the music.
We could.
It's great.
We could.
The main thing is that the richness and the diversity of this music gets a bigger airing, because too often I think we've just been confining our knowledge of Bach to the keyboard works, to the organ works, to just a handful of the great choral pieces, the B minor, which we're hearing at the moment, and the St. John and St. Matthew Passions. But there's so much more to him than that, and it's in the music that he wrote on a very regular, daily, weekly basis for the liturgy in Leipzig, which seems so parochial and so distant from our times, that actually you can find, I believe anyway, much more of the wrinkles of the way his mind worked and the type of man he was.
You write that experiencing Bach is a way of fully realizing the scale and scope of what it is to be human.
Yes.
You also write at the end of this book that Bach brings us the voice of God. Does that mean one has to be a believer to understand what it means to be human through the music of Bach?
No, I think he helps you, though. I think he's a tremendous ally, because he is so human himself, and that's the side that doesn't come over in the very stern, bewigged portrait that we have of him. As a pedagogue, as a devout Lutheran. Yeah, sure, he was a pedagogue. He was a brilliant teacher. Yes, he was a devout Lutheran. But he also had his moments of doubt, of dubiety, of crisis of belief. And that's not surprising in somebody who lost so many family members in the course of his life. He was orphaned at age 9 and a half, both parents gone. His first wife died, and the only time he ever stepped abroad, so many of his children, 20 children that he had, so many of them died before the age of 3. This is a man who was acquainted with grief, and yet found a way through his music of finding a release and also a comfort and a response and a vision of a better life and of an alternative existence. So on the one hand, yes, he is incredibly human and speaks for all of us, I think. Doesn't matter what our beliefs are. And on the other hand, he postulates for us a vision of a different life to which we can aspire as human beings on this planet through music, and through music making, the very act of music making.
You point to one of his pieces in particular on that front, the cantata Actus Tragicus. This is, yeah, what, written in his early 20s. He'd already
very
lost
early.
Both his parents. Had he lost children, and he would lose, as you say, something like 10 children in the course,
that's right,
of his life. But here, this is 1707. Of course, Bach lived from 1685 to 1750. If we may, listen to a little bit. You say this is the sound of Bach, I don't know if it's coming to terms with or transcending or simply grappling with all that death, Sir John?
Well, first of all, just setting the scene of just a marvelous kind of sepulchral funerary atmosphere, but with consolation rather than with morbidity.
Let's listen. There we are. It's almost... it can be overwhelming to listen to Bach. It was the family business, which maybe is one key to understanding how he could produce this only in his 20s.
Yes, and what strikes me as being so precocious in Bach is already the sense that it's not us that sets the clock of our lives, when it's going to begin and when it's going to end. It's out of our control. It's God who sets the clock. And we just have to submit to that and do our best in our own life and cope with all the problems that come our way.
You, back in the year 2000, the 250th year of his death, traveled Europe and the world performing so many of these cantatas, nearly 200, I think. Remind us of what the cantata was. This was not something you'd labor on for years. This was the weekly output of the cantor, of the man in charge of producing music to go along with the liturgy of the Lutheran Church.
It was indeed. It was a kind of anticipation of the sermon, which is the main event just before the communion service, on a weekly, on a Sunday basis, so that it was a kind of blueprint of what the preacher would say. Bach's problem was that he did it just too damn well, because he... through his powers of musical exegesis and through his fantasy and through his rich imagination and through the way he connected with these religious texts, managed to do such a good job, an eloquent job, beyond the capacity of any sermonizer. And that must have really got up the noses of the clergy in Leipzig, I guess. And because he was doing it in a way that challenged his listeners. And, you know, at a time when the services lasted 4 hours and in unheated churches, and the big event was, as I say, the sermon, and Bach would just announce it as people were coming into church for the main event. And people, being in Germany, they would give their greetings, and there would be a lot of formality and a lot of noise going on.
Mm-hmm.
So it must have been a challenge for him to grasp the attention of his listeners, but he did.
Can you imagine being the preacher who would step to the pulpit after this music? You're supposed to elaborate on this?
Yeah, I mean, words just fail, don't they? The music, it just has an eloquence and a tendency. Well, it's so multifaceted, isn't it? Because it can express a number of different things to different people at the same time. It can connect with the words at a very literal way, so that it colludes with the music and the words together, or it can collide. It can sort of bring a different slant, a different kind of emphasis by repeating words, by giving them an unexpected twist, and that's what makes it so mesmerizing. And that he should have sustained this output for 3 years in 1723 to 1726 was just amazing.
We think of him as a man who, through the power of his work, laid down almost rules for music, and yet you call him a radical, kind of revolutionary.
Well, I think, yes, I think that to me the polarization that you read in the history books and that is peddled to music students and all around the world, that, you know, you have Bach, the pedagogue, the formal, cold organ player, and Beethoven, the romantic radical, falsified, because there's a bits of both in each of them. In Beethoven, there is a lot of the stern discipline and the counterpoint and the rules, some of which he broke, of course, that you find in Bach. And in Bach, you find a lot of the passion and the romanticism and the intensity and the radicality and the willingness to challenge perceived conventions that you that's normally attributed to Beethoven.
I mean, we have listeners here saying, asking you, given that, given his willingness to press boundaries, if he were around today, would he be playing jazz or funk?
God knows. But, I mean, he would have been on the cutting edge, there's no question of it. He wouldn't have been delivering minimalist trash, that's for sure. He would have been doing something that would make us sit up and challenge all our preconceptions.
It's hard to imagine today, but he's with us more or less eternally here. Sir John Eliot Gardiner writes about the music of Bach and the man Bach in his wonderful new book, Bach, Music in the Castle of Heaven. I want to go out right here with the cantata Christ lag in Todesbanden, Christ lay in death's bonds, intended for performance in Easter 1707. John Eliot Gardiner describes the work as Bach's first known attempt at painting narrative in music. Here's the seventh movement. We'll look at that. John Eliot Gardiner, please stand by. New York listeners, you can join us. How do you explain the power of Bach's vocal works? The cantatas, the passions, the oratorios, the motets. Have you been lifted up, brought to your knees by this music? 800-423-8255 is our number. 800-423-TALK. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Tom Ashbrook, this is On Point. We're talking today with master conductor Sir John Eliot Gardiner about the music of Bach and the man who was Bach. His big new book goes deep on Bach's vocal works and the mind that made them, the mind, the times, the religion, the politics swirling around them. It is Bach, Music in the Castle of Heaven. You can read an excerpt and a playlist of this hour's music at our website, onpointradio.org. John Eliot Gardiner joins us from New York, and you can join us as well. Have you been lifted up, brought to your knees by this music? How do you imagine the mind that made it? When you think of Bach's music, do you think of mathematical precision, spiritual revelation, both? 800-423-8255 is our number. 800-423-TALK. John Eliot, tell us about this piece of music right now. We're going to compare it with something else. This is a religious text being written to here that his grandfather had also written to. But what's J.S. Bach writing to here?
Well, this is a cantata for the day of St. Michael and the victory, the legendary, almost allegorical victory of the forces of good over the forces of evil. Mm. And so it's celebrating Michael's victory. And it's a fantastic chorus because the chorus are joined together with the brass instruments of Bach's orchestra to give a brilliant sort of evocation of the celestial troops whirling around in the heavens and attacking Satan, his Satan's inner guard. And what I think is so spectacular here is the virtuosity that Bach demands of everybody, the players, the instrumentalists and the singers, and gets sort of a sense of the conflict and the struggle that's going on up there. And he learnt this, I think, from the example of his great-uncle, Johann Christoph Bach, who was the organist of Eisenach when he was growing up as a kid, and who wrote another wonderful setting of the same words. And there is much more a feeling of the evil spirits really kind of muttering and being subversive in the lower echelons of the heavens.
Maybe if we go to another portion of this same piece, what I think we have here...
Do you have the tenor aria?
Yeah, we have the aria.
Oh, that's amazing. Bleibt ihr Engel.
This kind of personal response to... This recitative describing the fragility of man, in contrast
right.
maybe to what Christoph Bach had written. Let's listen. So the earlier Bach had written music to this, now comes J.S. Bach, and where does he take it?
Well, you have to remember that Michael is not just the major general. He's not the Storm and Norman, as it were, of God's army. He is also the guardian angel and the bearer of the departed soul from earth to heaven. And this in this aria, the tenor is invoking the angels and the archangel Michael in particular, to stand by him in his hour of need as he faces death and faces judgment. And again, Bach, just as he does in the Actus Tragicus, he does this with inevitable tenderness and consolation and sensuality. And it absolutely gives the lie to the idea that he could never write a melody as beautiful as Schubert or as Mozart. I mean, he could and does on a frequent basis in the cantatas.
So here's a composer who can bring this tenderness, who can take us to the most sublime heights of spiritual insight.
Yep.
And the next thing you know, you're writing about him, you know, offending a bassoonist, and the next thing out in an alley with a gang and drawing his sword and... I mean, he's a rough-and-tumble, incorrigible guy at the same time.
Well, there's certainly the evidence that I uncovered when I was researching for this book shows that the classrooms and the circumstances of his schooling were about as rough as it ever gets, and they sound very contemporary to me. It sounds as if it could be happening right now, that guys showed up in class with daggers and there was overcrowding and they were throwing rocks through windows and there was all sorts of problems, and the school authorities were in despair as to how to control them. Now, there's no direct evidence that Bach was a gang leader in all this, but he was in that environment, he was in that context. And we do know for certain that he did draw his sword on this bassoonist who'd made a complete mess of one of his obbligatos, one of his solos. Bach did it in self-defense and then went to complain to the consistory the next day and say, look, I've been badly treated. And they sided with the bassoonist. And that kind of left a chip on his shoulder, and you feel it was there all through his life, his problem with authority, his problem with dealing with civil servants and administrators and often princely patrons who had not a clue about the range and the genius of the man. And he had to suffer fools gladly, and it was not easy for him.
How do you deal with what can look like a contradiction? People talk about him as, you know, the working class hero craftsman, ready to pull a sword if necessary, and yet he goes to these heights. I don't see you struggling with those as contradictions.
No, I don't at all. I think, just as, you know, we learnt through Amadeus Mozart, writing this absolutely heavenly, wonderful, natural music that we all adore, had a pretty scatological humour, had got up to all sorts of pranks and, you know, unsavoury habits of behaviour. We know that Beethoven was a bit of a monster in certain ways, but Bach, he wasn't a monster, of course not, but he was somebody who had experienced life in the raw, and I think it made him the greater musician than he was, because it gave him this sense of protest and anger that comes through particularly in the church cantatas when he's dealing with hypocrisy or insincerity or people who are corrupt in any way. Rather, he targets them in his cantatas, and you know the recitatives from his cantatas that pick out these people, they rain down on the congregation like Exocet missiles.
And he was willing to rain them down. We have some here from, this is cantata O Ewigkeit du Donnerwort.
Oh, yeah.
Here he is really sermonizing.
Oh, he's...
Let's listen.
Es dauerte der verdammten Qualen viele Jahr, als an der Zahl auf ihren Gras am Himmel Sterne wären. Gesetzt, es sei die Pein so weit hinausgestellt, als Menschen in der Welt von Anbeginn gewesen, so wäre doch zu.
It was given that the torment of the damned lasts as many years as the numbers of grass blades on the earth, as stars in heaven. He's just laying down.
Just like a preacher, and so much better, because he's doing it through music and through a wonderfully varied recitative. And he's writing as dramatic a recitative as any of his contemporaries, Handel, Vivaldi, Domenico Scarlatti, Alessandro Scarlatti, all of them at the time. He's the arch-dramatist of his age.
What's it like to be the maestro, the conductor who's channeling all this? Do you have to feel his passion about this message? Do you agree with it?
Not necessarily agree with it, but you had to subscribe to it in the moment because, you know, you can't sit on the fence and just judge it as a critic would do. You, as a performer, you are right in the center of the action and you're responsible for eliciting a vivid and eloquent response on the part of the singers and the continuo players and all the obbligato players in the orchestra and above all your chorus to do justice to Bach's vision. So yeah, you're an actor, you're a stage director, you're a conductor. You have to elicit that response, and it's hugely exciting and immensely demanding. I mean, the challenges of this music are just colossal. And you know, particularly in the year 2000 when we were doing three cantatas, yes, and sometimes more every Sunday on a weekly basis for 52 weeks in the year, that was just a marathon, an extraordinary experience which I've never experienced before and never expect to again. But it was a shot in the arm, I can tell you. And it was that gave me the impulse, the main impulsion to write this book.
It's an incredible immersion. I can't help just surging ahead with the music because that theatricality gets very... very high. Here's a piece. This is the Storm Aria from the cantata Jesus Sleeps, What Shall I Hope For?
This is incredible because this is the lone believer, as it were, tied to the mast of a ship that's sinking in the middle of Lake Galilee. It's the parable, yes, that you find in St. Matthew of the storm blowing up and Jesus sitting in the bows of the boat fast asleep. And the guy, completely paralyzed with fear and trying to wake Jesus up and say, come on, help me, help me, help me. And Bach goes hammer and tongs, full throttle out to convey the tsunami that's going on. And then suddenly, like a modern cinema director, he freezes the camera and you suddenly see a close-up of the, or you hear a close-up of the pilgrim stuck to the mast, inveighing and invoking Jesus. It's a brilliant little kind of jewel of a scene, all of its own.
What Paradise Lost might sound like if set to an opera, says Sir John Eliot Gardiner. Here we have the Storm Aria. Like Paradise Lost, if set to opera, and you remind us that Bach's great peers in this great age of music were in fact writing operas, and he wasn't putting this on stage. It's simply oral, but magnificently oral, almost beyond what you can put on stage.
That's the bit when he just, stops, freezes the camera. Yeah, look, you don't need the proscenium arch. You don't need costume and makeup and wigs. The drama's all in the music. And I think Bach was allergic in some... Well, not allergic, maybe too strong a word. I think he was put off by the conventions of opera of the day and decided, listen, I can do the same thing, only much, much more effectively in the context of a church.
Did it cost him in terms of his standing or his purse in those years not to be in the game of opera and those audiences?
Both. I would say both. I mean, the way to riches was definitely through opera, even though Handel later on almost bankrupted himself with his operatic kind of projects in London. When he, mind you, wouldn't it be a bit odd if a German, a Saxon, pitched up in London and put on Italian operas, opera series, to an English non-comprehending audience? I mean, there's something a bit fishy about that, yeah, right from the word go. But Bach was never a rich man. He never had worldly success in the way that Handel and Vivaldi, well, Vivaldi to a less extent, but Handel had particularly, or Telemann, his exact contemporary, had.
Yes.
But what he did have was this incredible ability to vivify the word, and vivify the Christian word and the Christian message on his own terms. And he got into trouble, deep trouble, with the clergy of the day, because they said, you shall not bring opera into church. And he did.
Minus the costumes, but everything just as vivid. Sir John Eliot Gardner is with us. His wonderful new book is Bach, Music in the Castle of Heaven. We have callers for you. Idaho Falls, Idaho. Quinn is calling. Quinn, you're on the air with Sir John Eliot Gardner.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for taking my call.
Yes. Hi.
A lot of what you have mentioned has really resonated with me. You and your guest, I remember at 17 years old being introduced to, I had a new piano teacher, and she had introduced me to more of Bach, and I'd also joined a chorale at that time that her husband did, where we did the Bach Mass in B minor. And I just remember at, I think it was the last piece in that Mass, it had the same tune of the Dona Nobis Pacem, so I can't remember the name.
Yeah, you're
of it,
right.
But it had the same. Yeah.
But he uses, and, you're right, he uses the Gratias at the beginning and uses the same music, identical, but with a different a series of stresses and emphases for the Dona Nobis Pacem. You're right.
Yes, yeah. And just how difficult it was for me to sing that at the time, tears flooding my eyes, overcome with emotion, just the beauty of that. The whole, it was like the accumulation of the entire Mass, and what you had mentioned earlier about those churchgoers sitting in the cathedral, and I'm not as well versed in the cantatas, but the power of that music, and also being introduced to more jazz through this music teacher, and going, oh man, this is great stuff, and she says, well, you know where it all originated, and of course, back to Bach. And the more I studied Bach, I realized that, true, I mean, you listen to those cadences and progressions and chords, and it was just so cutting edge at the time, but still the foundation for most we have.
Still even
into jazz, the cadence, the progression, the chords. Thank you, Quinn, for that from Idaho Falls. I mean, do you hear that progression right on down through our jazz age?
Yeah, I do. I mean, I don't think there's hardly a composer I can think of from the late 18th century all through the 19th, 20th into our time that hasn't in some profound way been influenced by Bachian harmony, counterpoint and rhythm, the three elements that are really the sort of syntax and grammar of his creation. And all serious jazz musicians would doff their caps to Bach and say, yeah, he's the master. Well, that's where we got it from originally.
There's much more that we're going to hear in this hour with Sir John Eliot Gardner. He writes about Bach, the man, and his music, as maybe only a maestro can, the one who's conducted so many of this pieces of vocal work from Johann Sebastian Bach. His big new book is Bach, Music in the Castle of Heaven. Joins us today from New York, and you can join us here as well. This, the cantata motet, O Jesu Christ, something between a cantata movement and a motet chorale transcription. Do you hear a rule man or revolutionary in the music of Bach? Do you hear a radical? Now, do you picture the composer who would draw a sword on a bassoonist and then deliver the voice of God? 800-423-8255 is our number. 800-423-TALK. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're listening to Bach this hour, looking at the life of Johann Sebastian Bach and his music through the eyes, ears of great maestro, conductor Sir John Eliot Gardner. His new book is Bach, Music in the Castle of Heaven, a kind of combination of biography and meditation of one who has interpreted and conducted this music on the man and the music. You can join us, 800-423-8255, 800-423-TALK. How do you explain the power of Bach's vocal works? Was Einstein right? As Sir John Eliot Gardner quotes him, that we should, well, he more or less said, we should just shut up and listen. Maybe so. 800-423-8255. Behind us here, Bach's Sleeper Wake chorale cantata, performed by Sir John Eliot Gardner, the English Baroque soloist, and the Monteverdi Choir. Lots of response online here. Ed writes to us, the B minor mass, which we heard very high in the hour. The greatest single piece of music ever written. That kind of superlative comes to the music of this composer. Colleen writes to us, John Eliot says, Bach is the best. The B minor mass chokes me up, and I'm in no way a religious believer. And when I'm not choked up, I'm dancing, and I'm not even going into the instrumental music, she writes. Dave writes, when I listen to J.S. Bach, I hear something beyond music, an organic sound that seems to originate from some celestial being. All right.
The Castle of Heaven.
Castle of Heaven, exactly. What about it? You're writing something here between biography and channeling that unnameable thing. What do you say to Dave?
Well, it's a mug's game. I mean, writing about music.
Yes.
It's much easier to stand up and conduct it, I promise you. Even the most challenging of compositions by the most challenging of composers is easier than writing about it. I mean, music is so imprecise. Music is metaphor. Music is colour, but... words are metaphor. Words are colour. Mm-hmm. I try and give the flavour as best I can in this book of what the music suggests and the imagery that it suggests to me. I'm not at all sure I've succeeded, but I've had a go at it because it's been such a vital and living presence in my whole life's experience from being a toddler, really, growing up under the portrait of Bach, the famous portrait with a wig on. Which
was in your home through some amazing World War II events. There to be kept safe from the Nazi onslaught, you literally walked up your family's steps looking at that bewigged Lutheran cantor.
I did. And then saw it for the first time again after 50, 60 years in William Scheider's house in Princeton, New Jersey. And that was so moving to see it again. And I got a different feel about it. I used to feel it was very intimidating. And now I think I can penetrate through to the humanity of the man. It's quite an astute portrait. But writing about music is, as I say, is a very, very difficult and challenging thing. But what I try to do in this book is to somehow knock on the head some of the myths about Bach, the fact that he is, so superhuman that we can't even get near him. We can get near him as a man. We certainly can. There are traces in his biography and in the circumstances and in his own letters, few and far between, of what kind of temperament that he was. And it's that kind of flawed individual that fascinates me, that should be perfection in music and emanating from an imperfect human being. I find that deeply touching and very interesting, much more interesting than if it just... It emanated from, the fifth evangelist, as the Lutherans would have us believe.
Did his contemporaries have this sense that Dave writes to us, he feels like there's some celestial being speaking here. Did his contemporaries listen and say, there's a superhuman composer among us? Or
no.
They simply were on the ramp with him, on the way with him?
They saw him primarily as a brilliant performer, as a brilliant improviser, as a brilliant organist. They were critical. His peers were critical of his writing, his compositions. And mind you, so little of it was published in his lifetime, and only one of the 200 surviving cantatas actually was printed in his lifetime. That's so extraordinary. And they were critical, in some cases, of it being too dense, too bombastic, too turgid. Now, that to me is very difficult to understand, because to me it's the opposite. It's got a lightness when it requires lightness. It's got a seriousness. That we heard earlier that wonderful bass recitative when he's really talking about what the final judgment it could be like for the damned, as it were. It's got everything. It's got the whole range of human emotions. And he is the first composer in the history of music after Monteverdi, who started the whole process, who catalogued and managed to encapsulate in musical terms the full range of human passions. And he's doing it in the context of church music at a time when church music was really in its last dying gasps, because, you know, the Lutheran Church was, yes, in a state of renewal in the early years of the 18th century, but it was about to be eclipsed and to disappear right underneath the surface line because of the Enlightenment and the Scientific Revolution.
Music so breaking out of the church.
That's right. So this was a critical moment in history. And one of the things that I've concluded is that this music could only have written by this man in this particular place, in provincial, mean-spirited Leipzig, where he was surrounded by clerics and by politicians who really didn't understand what he was doing and who did everything they could to torpedo his efforts in many, many ways, and that it could only have happened at that particular juncture in history. Anything later and it would have just disappeared.
Was he guarded from the Enlightenment waves there somehow in that provincial?
No, I don't think so. He didn't have a university education, so to extent he was sort of sealed from the higher kind of intellectual and scientific debates of the day, but he was made to pay for that. I think he was made to feel kind of inferior because he didn't have a higher education. He couldn't afford it. He was an orphan, and he struggled, and he had to get employment pretty quickly in his life to make ends meet, and then he had a huge family. No, I think Bach was a deep thinker, but not in a conventional way. And I think he also was a mathematician, an intuitive mathematician, or a grandmaster of chess, as it were, somebody who could anticipate 5 or 6, 7 moves ahead as to how his music could evolve. There's a lovely story of him talking to Carl Philipp Emanuel, his second son, when they're listening to an organ prelude and fugue being played. And Bach says, I've got that theme, I've got that theme. Now, this is how they're going to be combined. You wait for this, my boy. And sure enough, when they come, you know, he nudges his son in the ribs and says, what did I tell you? Yeah. So there is this fantastic sense of him being the master of all the means of production, all the elements of music making.
It's so ethereal, and yet in some ways you can't listen and help hear it presaging the Enlightenment and the whole scientific revolution.
I agree.
All that math that just seems to be exploding and whirling here. One of our listeners, Kartik Lakshmi, says, could you please explore the mathematics behind Bach's music in a way that a beginner would understand? I mean, it seems, you say intuitive, but he seems to have a lock on a whole universe of formulae here that he can throw out.
Yes, but I don't think that he sat down and ruled his manuscript paper at the beginning and saying, right, I'm going to have exactly 110 bars here and 117 bars there and 100 whatever it is bars there. I think it was a much more natural sense of just proportion and of equilibrium, that he responded to that at an intuitive level rather than at a cerebral level. And yes, later on in life, he would go back and correct and add a bar or subtract a bar here to make it fit with with natural proportions. It's a mystery, the actual compositional processes of Bach. I devote a whole chapter to him at his workbench, trying to uncover how he started the whole process of invention, and then imitatio, imitation, elaboratio, elaboration, and so on, and the different stages that this happened. And then, of course, in performance, which is part of the creative act, how he leaves traces of his own performance in his music. And that's the thing that we, as interpreters in the 21st century, can benefit, and we can pick up on that. And that gives us hope, really.
is the opening to the St. John Passion Sacred Oratorio by J.S. Bach. This was during the first winter that he was responsible for church music at the St. Thomas Church and the St. Nicholas Church in Leipzig. Composed the St. John Passion for the Good Friday Vespers. Passion, that term for almost holy opera. So John Elliott Gardiner here, another one of these pieces and moments where we just feel swept away.
This is a huge tableau, isn't it? It's like a great big painting, like by, I don't know, Tintoretto, Veronese, mm-hmm. Rubens, mm-hmm. Rembrandt. And what's going on here? It's layered complexity. I mean, you've got a bass line that's throbbing along on the same note. For a lot of the time, you've got a swirling, whirling figure going on in the violas, and in, which suggests the tumult of the crowd that's coming to watch the crucifixion, both with horror or with devotion. Mm. Then you've got these angular, dissonant clashings of notes between the oboes and the flutes, and which suggests, you know, the nails being driven into bare flesh,
yes.
Which is hot, gruesome. And then on top of that, you've got the chorus singing of Christ in Majesty, like a great Byzantine kind of fresco or mosaic. So there's so many different aspects of this experience which the listener is required to absorb all one at the same time. It's amazing.
Ed in Montpelier, Vermont. Ed, thank you for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, thanks. Hello, Tom.
Hi.
I grew up listening to and playing country music and folk music, and it wasn't until I was about 20 that I discovered Bach. I had a recording of Casals playing the cello suites, and it just made me start taking cello lessons. I was determined to learn to play the suites, and it's been a major part of my life, this that really glorious labor.
What pulled you off your country folk track? How do you describe that the hand that grabbed you from Bach's music to pull you over?
Well, I had previously thought that occasionally I would hear Bach and I thought, oh, that's 1-2-3-4, 1-2-3-4, so boring. And one day I heard it on the radio, and before I had the chance to turn the dial, it hit me. I heard it for the first time, and wow, it was a life-changing experience.
For you and for so many, more here, Mass in B minor from Bach. John Elliott, we hear the turn there in the great Mass in B minor from that dark open to this brilliant glory.
Well, you see, that's what makes the B minor Mass such an extraordinarily moving piece, that if it hadn't been for Bach's doubts and his struggles with belief, then this wonderful exuberant music, this sort of sprint to the line of I believe in the resurrection of the souls would have not functioned properly. You have to go through one to get to the other. And it's quite amazing. This is the kernel of the B minor Mass. You know, credo, I believe in this, I believe in that, I believe in all the rest of the things, and then suddenly, do I believe? Oh, gosh, I'm not sure I do. And Bach inserts chromatic searching modulations and passages where the outcome is far from secure. And that's so touching to me, and it suggests again that there is a human, a beating heart, as well as a prodigious mind that stands behind this music.
Not completed this until 1749, just the year before his death. All that exuberant glory and declaration, and then Do I Believe, an almost modern note.
Well, certainly a Beethovenian one.
Incredible. Incredible music, incredible life, and maybe a view of it that only a conductor can have. I mean, cantata after cantata, piece after piece, you've helped bring this music to life again. Does it leave you feeling a special bond with the man, John Elliott?
Oh, certainly. Absolutely. I mean, a mind as prodigious as that you think is ineffable. I'll never get anywhere near it. But yes, there are traces, there are encouraging signs, there are little bits that you can latch on to. And this particular movement is one as a case in point. And your previous caller talking about the Bach cello suites and the way Casals played them, that to me resonates too, because, you know, it's so powerful, so powerful.
Crozet writes to us, singing Bach's cantatas and masses is one of the highlights of my personal musical experience. And many, many, many millions who have shared that experience. Sir John Elliott Gardiner writes about the music in a way that maybe only a maestro can, and the man who made it, in his big, marvelous new book, Bach, Music in the Castle of Heaven. Sir John Elliott Gardiner, in New York with us today, thank you very much for the book and for your time with us today, for your time with this music with us. Thank you.
You're very welcome.
Go out with St. Matthew Passion, the finale to Bach's glorious St. Matthew Passion. Thanks for joining us today. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
On Point is a production of WBUR Boston and NPR.